Podcasting from the beautiful Mile High City, you're listening to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the undisputed leader in no-holds-barred, catch-as-catch-can wrestling. Here's your host, Jake Shannon.
Thank you for tuning in to the Do It Again podcast, the official podcast of Scientific Wrestling, the leader in no holds barred catches catch can wrestling. I'm your host, Jake Shannon. And man, this is a guy I've known. We were talking before the show started for a while. And God damn it if I don't want people to know who he is and benefit from his experience in the business, his knowledge. Just a great guy, a really good friend of mine for a long time. Professional wrestler with the UWFI. In fact, I think he can correct me if I'm wrong, he was ranked number two in that organization, and that was full of badasses like Bad News Allen, the Gary Albright, the Suplex Machine, Sakuraba, Tamura. I mean, the man is amazing. And on top of that, here's a guy who ran Lou Fez's gym with him for years. So without any further ado, let's just get to it. Mark Fleming, are you there, Mark?
Yeah. Hey, Jake, how you doing?
I'm doing super. I'm just really excited to hopefully get people to know about you and your life and your story and benefit from your like crazy huge experience in the professional wrestling game. And by that, I don't mean bodybuilders and feather boas yelling at each other. I'm talking real wrestling. Maybe the best way to start is can you just tell people, you know, kind of your evolution, you know, just your quick kind of like how you started in it. Not in pro wrestling, but just in combat sports in general. And then, you know, kind of up to UWFI or even after.
Well, I started as an amateur at 13 years old. I was kind of big for my age, and I was a little too young to wrestle in the high school level. My junior high school coach had a intramurals team in junior high, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to wrestle, you know, with the high school boys to learn. So I go up to the high school, and the high school wrestling coach told me that I was too young at 13. And I guess he recognized the enthusiasm I had for wrestling and wanting to learn.
Yeah.
And of course, he saw my size for my age. And he told me I was too young, but he says, I'll take an exception. You're big, you know, and I can see that you're really interested. He said, just come up here to the high school every day, and I'll let you work out with the high school boys. And that's basically how I got started and then, you know, worked my way up all the way through school. I never went to college to wrestle. This may sound funny, but that wasn't my goal. I love amateur wrestling, but I was just like every other fan of professional wrestling. I saw it on TV as a kid, and I loved the sport. I wasn't watching it for the theatrics or the gimmicks and all that. I was watching it, oddly enough, as a sport and watching the guys suplex, put these crazy holds on each other, throwing each other around. That just interests me. I know that's kind of odd for being a kid, but it really did. So anyway, I just thought how to do this. It was just to start wrestling in school. But
is in North Carolina. Is that right?
No, this is Virginia.
Oh, in Virginia. Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up in Virginia.
In Virginia, sorry.
Right. And, you know, I went through high school and I did pretty good as an amateur, and that's a couple of offers. No big schools, but that didn't interest me to wrestle. Of course, I played football in high school also. But my main objective and really concentrate on was to get in the pro ranks or find out about it or something. but it was so much kayfabe back then. I'm talking in the early 70s, you know? Mm-hmm. And finally, when I graduated, I had become friends with, well, not friends, with acquaintance, with a guy named Ricky Steamboat. I would go down to the local arena here and watch him wrestle, and wow. Him and I would talk about amateur wrestling.
Wow.
And I would tell him all about my the tournaments I would win and what I was doing this coming season and what weight class I was wrestling. He was very interested in hearing about the amateurs and what I was doing. So I told him I wanted to try this stuff, but he just kind of thought, well, you know, this is a hard business. It's nothing like amateur, which I already recognized. And finally, after I graduated, he said, look, write up a resume of all the tournaments that you won and your record and what you did in the amateurs and what you did in football and all that good stuff. Give it to me. Have some pictures made of you, your wrestling stance or whatever, so they can see what you look like. And I will give your resume to Jim Crockett. That was Jim Crockett Promotions out of Charlotte, North Carolina at the time. And so I did that and never heard anything for months. And finally got a call one day telling me they have a yearly tryout for Crockett and they look for new talent. And if I wanted to try out, come down to the Charlotte Coliseum, you know, on a certain date. And well, I did that. And it was an all day tryout. I mean, it lasted from early in the morning until late afternoon. And it was at the Charlotte Coliseum. And we had like 27 guys, I want to say, 20-some guys there, and I was second to the smallest at the weigh-ins. I weighed 200 pounds. There was a guy that weighed like 190-something that was smaller than me, and the rest of the guys were like college athletes, a lot of college football players, some college wrestlers, some there was some bodybuilders there and some powerlifters, and I was just an amateur wrestler right out of high school. I didn't know nothing, and so we went through our workout that Ole and Gene Anderson conducted the tryouts.
Oh, wow. And
yeah, they were really tough. They had a bad reputation as being badasses, and they lived up to it, I'm telling you.
Oh, I bet. Now, Mark, sorry to interrupt, but there's something. You're rubbing the microphone. I can hear a little bit of like loud rubbing noise on the microphone. Just so you know. No worries. Just so people who are listening don't have to listen to all that too. So yeah, I mean, Ole and Arn Anderson, that was like your first exposure. Now, hold on though. Cause I mean, I've known you, we were talking a little bit before. I mean, it really blew my mind cause we've known each other since like way back in 2003. We're coming up on like 15, 20 years or something.
Right.
So I'm sorry, but I can't let you just glide by on some of the cool shit you done. Because you wrestled in high school, but, I mean, you won championships in high school. It wasn't just that you were on the wrestling team, but, I mean, you really excelled, too.
You know, I did okay. I wasn't the best wrestler on the team by no means. I wrestled several different weight classes. I guess my coach recognized that I had some kind of talent because he always strived to find a spot for me on the varsity team. I was always challenging guys a couple of grades ahead of me to make the team because we had challenge matches every week. Mm. And we had to prove ourselves every week. Once you made varsity or JV, your job wasn't sewed up. You had to prove yourself weekly. At practice on challenge matches. So it kept us on our toes and kept us in shape. And, you know, you could wrestle varsity one week and the next week you wouldn't because you lost your challenge match. Well, fortunately for me, that never happened. I was always, I just always was fortunate enough to win my challenge matches. And I won some tournaments. Sophomore year, I lost a tremendous lot of weight. I was playing ball at 190. And right before wrestling season, my coach told me he wanted me to go 155 weight class. So
oh
I had to lose a lot of weight in a couple of weeks. So I lost 17 pounds in 2 days.
Oh.
And I was predicted to win this tournament, this district tournament, which is a big deal here in Tidewater. I was predicted to win my weight class. And I had lost so much weight, and I was dehydrated, and I came in third. But, you know, that kind of disappointed me. But the following years after that, my junior and senior year, I wrestled 167, 185, and I did pretty good. But as far as the best wrestler on the team, no, I had to work for it. Some guys are naturals.
Yeah.
I was there. I mean, I was the type of guy that was really ridiculous and overbearing about it. I was at practice early, and I stayed late. And my coach used to say, golly, you don't have to worry about me, because I was always working. You know, guys talking about going out on dates and all this. And I would always go running or lift weights or stay in the wrestling room longer. And I don't know. You know, I just loved it. And,
yeah.
You know, it paid off, I guess.
Well, and for people who are listening, another guy that I really admire, and I think I should probably get him on the show, because is Scott Teal. And you and Scott put together this amazing book, which is basically the biography of your life, autobiography. It's called It's Wrestling, Not Wrestling. It's Wrestling, Not Wrestling. So you got to go look that up on Amazon. And it details this with a bunch of great pictures and stuff. And I was flipping through here, like page 12, and it talks about you got your first wrestling magazine, June 1973 issue of Wrestling World with Vern Gagne on the cover. And then another one, you bought your first magazine, and it had Joe LeDuc's blood-covered face. Anyway, you guys got to get this book. It's really very, very well done, and it details all this kind of stuff. So, okay, so you kick ass as a high schooler. You're not the best, but you're good, and you definitely got talent, and your long vision is to get into the pro game. And so, you know, you said you knew Ricky Steamboat, but you know, I kind of relevant to now, and maybe you could just say a few words. It said in the book, your first the first pro wrestler you met was Pedro Morales.
Yeah, I like I say, I would always go to the matches when I was in high school, and I would, you know, watch the matches, and I was just a fan. And I started talking to Pedro Morales, and he was a pretty nice guy, and he, you know, would talk to you. Some of them wouldn't, but he would. And I was telling him, you know, my goals. And, you know, he was like, stay in school, kid, you know, keep wrestling amateur, stay in school. Don't, I didn't get any encouragement from these guys at all. And, because, you know, it's a 1,001 shot, really. And, but yeah, he told me about Killer Kowalski's wrestling school up in Reading, Pennsylvania at the time. Reading, Massachusetts, I believe. And they sent me some stuff in the mail, but wow, I couldn't afford the tuition. I mean, it was like, for the training, it was almost $2,000, and that was back in the 70s. So,
wow.
I didn't have that money, so I just kicked that to the curb. And then, you know, a couple years later, I started talking to Steamboat, and Steamboat's the only one that really showed me any encouragement, because he was kind of, he showed a lot of interest in my amateur wrestling, because I would tell him, man, I just won this tournament this weekend, or I just won the championship in my weight class here in Virginia. And he seemed impressed with that, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think he was impressed by my amateur background. And he's really the one that kind of said, okay, well, I'll tell you what you need to do to get this thing done. But he warned me, it's tough. He says, let me tell you, it's going to be the toughest thing you ever tried to do. And he says, and let me tell you, if you don't make it, he says, don't be ashamed of yourself, because 99% of the guys do not make it to these trials.
Yeah.
He said, he's seen some good athletes. He won't even go to them and watch them, because they're so brutal. He told me that. He says, only advice I can tell you is be in the best shape you've ever been and just be ready for a hell of a getting your ass kicked. And, you know, it didn't bother me because I was ready, man. I really knew what I wanted to do and I was focused. I was training a lot. No, I wasn't the biggest guy in the world. Like I say, I was 200 pounds when I went to the tryouts, but I was in shape. I was in wrestling shape. I could go on the mat for a long time.
Yeah.
And,
so then you get this tryout with the Andersons, but I mean, it was pretty rough, right? I mean, they just basically were just stretching the shit out of you guys to see who could hang.
It's the toughest workout I've ever been to this day.
Wow.
I mean, yeah, it was brutal. Just the calisthenics and the exercises before we even got in the ring was brutal. Buddy carries up and down the Coliseum stairs. You had to run a mile in a certain, I can't remember the amount of time. We had to do Russell Austin round robin, wrestle each other. We had to do 100 push-ups nonstop. You stop, you were cut. I mean, there was no slack at all. I mean, it was a little ridiculous. And they were, it was just, I tell you, my dad went with me. They would let spectators in the Coliseum to watch. And my dad had seen me wrestle just about every amateur match that I wrestled in. And he watched me wrestle that day, and he says, I don't know what it is or what got into you. He said, but I've never seen you wrestle that well. And I don't know. I guess it was just meant to be. But
all those years of preparation, though, because that was your goal. I mean, you were a high school wrestler, but you weren't wanting to go to the Olympics. You weren't getting that so you could do what you needed to do that day, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I was looking at it as that was my goal. And like a lot of guys wanted to play pro football, or like you say, amateur wrestlers go to college and wrestle or Olympics or whatever. My goal was professional wrestling, and I was dead serious about it. It was crazy.
So during that tryout, you said you guys had to wrestle round robin. That's like you're actually wrestling, not sports entertainment. But you guys were actually going at it, right?
Oh, yeah. This was all a shoot. Everything was a shoot. We knew nothing. You got to remember, nobody there knew anything about working a hold. Everything was kayfabe back then.
Yeah. And for people who don't know what kayfabe is, that is, I mean, like the protection of the business because, you know, a lot of it was worked. Well, at that time, all of it was worked. But the presentation to the general public was that it was a legitimate contest. And so kayfabe is this idea that comes from the carnivals. That you got to protect the business.
Kayfabe is a carny word for the old carnival wrestlers. That's one of the words they use. That's where it came from.
You know what I think it is? You remember Pig Latin?
Yes. It's just like Pig Latin.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you say the word fake, it comes out kayfabe.
Well, that's right, and the old carny guys used to talk what they call carny talk, but it was like Pig Latin.
Yeah.
When I first broke in, a lot of the old timers would talk to us that way, and it took me a while. Mike Rotundo, who was a Syracuse wrestler and a pro wrestler, taught me carny talk. Riding around the territory in a car because a lot of the guys will call matches in carny talk. Yeah. The old timers, not the new guys, but
that's fascinating. So your dad sees you do this workout, you nail the workout, even though it's totally brutal. And was that like where you first kind of got brought in as an athlete to actually get paid to wrestle?
Yeah, well, it wasn't that easy. Once I made the tryout, me and two other guys made the tryout. And then we had to report back to Charlotte to start our training. Probably, I guess, I don't know, 4 or 5 months. Gene Anderson was in charge of training us. And what he would do, he would put us through the calisthenics and then he would bring in another wrestler, a real shooter, to work out with us. And that would be like Don Kernodle, who was an Elon College wrestler, Mike Rotundo. And these guys could really go. Jerry and Jack Briscoe, and they would just stretch us. Well, one of the guys that had made it with me eventually quit because the workouts were tough. And so it just ended up being me and this other guy. And this other guy was huge. He was like 275. I was like, by that time, I was up to 220 because Ole Anderson told me to get up to 220 before I started training. So I had gotten myself up to 220. So here I was rolling around with this guy who was just huge. He was like a bouncer at some bar down in South Carolina where he was from. He was just this big, huge guy. But he was uncoordinated, strong as an ox, but didn't know anything about wrestling. Never wrestled amateur. And I would just, on the mat, really, he was like a fish out of water.
I would just.
And, of course, Gene and Ole liked that, you know. But one day, Gene just came up to me and told this other guy we were working out on the mat. He says, look, you really don't have what it takes. He says, but then he looked at me, he says, but you... I want to start talking about booking you. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. I felt like, wow, I'm not ready. Well, this was about 6 months or almost a year. Actually, it was about 11 months from the time I made the tryouts when he told us that.
Wow.
And I hadn't done much training down there. I would have gone down there about 6 or 7 times, catching a Greyhound bus to go down there because the car I had wouldn't make the it was too far to drive from Virginia to Charlotte. Wouldn't make it. So I had to catch a Greyhound bus to go down there and train.
Yeah, that's dedication. I mean, you know, you just don't really see that much anymore. You see a few guys that just really want it that bad. And, you know, I mean, that's amazing.
But, you know, he kind of threw me to the wolves. Gene did, because I think he realized that I was shocked at him telling me that he wanted to start booking me. And he said, look, kid, he says, you know, with his rough voice, he had this crazy voice. He said that you would learn on the road. He says the best way to learn is to get in there and actually do it.
Yeah.
Well, that was tough. That was getting there, thrown in there with some of those guys. Some of the guys they matched me up against were some of the old timers that had already had their hurrah. Now they were on their way down in their career, and they would just eat you alive.
What are some of the worst, when you were green, who were some of the worst guys to wrestle back then?
Oh, I had this guy named Larry Lane. They called him Red Dog Lane. He was from Colorado. He was trained by Dory Funk Jr.'s father in Amarillo.
Wow.
He was a champion in the Marine Corps. He'd been wrestling, I don't know, probably 20, 30 years.
Wow.
He was just
tough.
A mean son of a bitch, I'm telling you. They booked me against him just about every night for a while. And, oh, my gosh, he would tie me up in knots and slap me around. And all it was it was nothing against me, which I finally learned years later. It was just they wanted to find out what you were made of.
Yeah.
If you were tough enough to stay in the game and see if you can last.
And how much bullshit you'd put up with too. Cause I mean, I had one guy run my face on the ring ropes back when I was wrestling, and that was my wake up. I was like, I ain't fucking doing that. And I started fighting back a little bit, you know?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Well, you have to show them, man. They'll take advantage of you.
Yeah.
You know, it was nothing about rules or anything like that. And then not only in the ring action or the punishment in the ring, it was punishment on the road as far as traveling with these guys. You were the young kid. They called you new meat. You were, you had to put up with being ribbed all the time. You understand?
Yeah.
I mean, these guys played ribs on you. They would just do anything to mess with your mind to see if you were mentally and physically enough to take the business, basically. And there was a few times there that I said, you know, I don't know if I'm cut out for this. But, you know, I finally just, I don't know, I started fighting back and showing them what I had, and they finally started accepting me, seeing that I was going to stick around. They weren't going to get rid of me.
Yeah.
But and then you're accepted. Then you're one of the boys, you know. Then once you're one of the boys, you know, you can go ahead and work and do your thing.
Well, and you, I mean, you've worked your ass off too. I mean, you've had so many like amazing matches. One of the ones, and we're gonna take a break here for our sponsors because we do gotta make sure we keep the lights on around here. But I think you recently posted a picture. I can't remember. Tell me if I'm wrong. But you even wrestled Ken Shamrock before he was Ken Shamrock. He was Vito, what was his, Vito Torelli?
Vince Torelli.
That's right. And I want you to tell some of those stories, some of the guys you've wrestled, some of your travels. And then maybe we can get in a little bit with your time with Lou, because I think that is absolutely crucial, especially with regards to kind of what this podcast is about. It's really about catch as catch can. And, you know, I think it's important for people to understand that catch is such an amazing practice, because not only can you kick ass and do well in real wrestling and real grappling, but then it'll also take you to the very top of the game in the pro game, in the sports entertainment game. So I want to kind of touch on all that stuff and your thoughts and your experiences when we come right back. Is that all right with you, Mark?
Yes, sure.
Okay, guys, hang tight. We'll be right back with Mark Fleming. Thanks for tuning in. Okay, before the break, we were, I'm really thrilled to have with us Mark Fleming. And before the break, we were talking about his beginnings, how he started out as an amateur and worked his way, even though he was an amateur, his goal was always to get into pro wrestling. He breaks into the business and how rough it is. It's different nowadays, especially with these giant mega corporations. I mean, hell, WWE, I was looking at their financials. Their stock, if you aggregate all, their market capitalization is $8 billion. That company is worth $8 billion on, you know, if you sold all the stock or whatever. It's a different time now, because I know that they have like a performance center and they're training these guys and all that, and that's great. But it was not like that, and it was really tough to break into the business, and you did damn well. So you get that first job after like 11 months, and then you bust ass on the road, which, you know, is a pain in the ass too, because that's a hard lifestyle choice. And you're getting beat up every day and you got to go to these new things. And then you're getting ribbed constantly, people stealing your clothes or hiding them from you and shit.
That's right.
So what were some of the pivotal matches where you kind of went from, you know, being fresh meat to being like one of the boys? Where was that? What happened for you? Where do you think that transition was?
Well, the first transition, I think I opened some of the guys' eyes, was I was wrestling with that same guy I was just telling you about, Larry Red Dog Lane. I was booked with him on a big card in Greensboro Coliseum in North Carolina. And Greensboro was a big, big club for us, you know. It always drew big money. And we were wrestling, and he kept messing with me. I mean, and he was just giving me cheap shots, elbows to the jaw, just slapping me around. And I lost my temper. I had just had it with this guy. I'd been working with this guy every day for like 3 months, and I was over him. And I lost it. I just snapped. And I hit him with the forearm across his jaw as hard as I could. And he goes out of the ring and lands right on his ass, right on the cement floor outside the ring.
Oof.
There was no mats around the ring back then.
Oof.
And, you know, he got up and he's holding his jaw, you know, and he got back in the ring, and I was like, all right, I'm ready. You know, you want to do something, let's do it. I was ready for him. He says, damn, kid, that was a hell of a hit. And after that, I had never had a problem with him.
Yeah.
But I wrestled him 100 times after that and never had a problem.
Yep.
So I think that's what he wanted. He wanted to really get to me and see what I was made of. And I showed him, and I was okay with him. And, you know, it's just all about respect. Back then it was.
Yep.
And try to be accepted, because it was such a close camaraderie. in the professional wrestling world. I mean, these guys didn't accept just anybody. It's not like now. You didn't have a lot of independent groups where these guys just book anybody.
Yeah.
I mean, you had, this might sound crazy, you had to know how to wrestle and take care of yourself. You really did. And I tell these guys today this, and they look at me like I'm crazy. You know, it wasn't about so much about what gimmick you had breaking in. It was about if you can handle yourself when you broke in. And that's the big difference today.
It's way different. I mean, these young guys, man, it has to do with, like, how many social media followers they have. And it's so weird. Like,
and you got to remember, when I was coming up, there was no such thing as MMA.
Yeah.
You know, if you wanted to wrestle and get paid for it, make a living, it had to be professional wrestling. There was no MMA for us to strive for, to get involved in. You know, we didn't know it was no such thing. And it was just professional wrestling, either that or the Olympics, you know.
Where you make no money at all.
Yeah. But I mean, if you wanted to be a professional, there was no MMA organization that you can work for to get into, or like UFC or whatever it's called. And it was just professional wrestling.
And that's, to me, that's the shame. I mean, you're older than me by a clip, but, you know, I'm 46, and, you know, I was at the very first, at the second UFC, and I'd already seen the UWFI pay-per-view, you know, and all that stuff, and it's a damn shame, because so many people look down their noses at pro wrestling in this age of MMA, and it's like, well, God damn it, you don't know what it was like back then. There was nothing else you could do. So guys like yourself, guys like Luthez, guys like Carl Gotch, Billy Robinson, all those guys who were legit shooters, they loved it so much they were willing to go into pro wrestling. And, you know, it's a damn shame that people look down their noses at it, because I think it's a shame.
Well, look at somebody like, take Danny Hodge.
Yes.
You know, Danny, look what he did in the amateurs. Mm. Okay, once he got out of the amateurs, he went to Leroy McGurk to get booked in the pros, right?
Mm.
Okay, he could have gone into MMA if they'd have had it. Can you imagine him being in MMA if he was in his prime today?
Oh, shit, they couldn't take that belt off of him until he wanted to.
Yeah, I mean, so, but there was no such thing as that back then, and so what do? They go to pro wrestling, just like Carl Gotch, just like Luthez.
Yep.
Like, look at Billy Wicks. I mean, yep. You know, all these guys that could wrestle, they had to go into pro wrestling to make money.
Yeah, Dick Cardinal. I mean, Dick Cardinal won a bunch of high school shit, and then he made a living on the Carney circuit. You know, he's still around. He's like, he's got to be 93.
Yeah, I heard. But these guys, and just like Red Bastien is another one. I knew Red Bastien pretty well.
Me too.
He told, you know, he was on the Carney circuit, and he starved to death. He didn't make much money. That's why he had to get in the professional style. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
So that's all we had. We didn't have any MMA or any other type of martial arts to get involved in back then.
Well, and that's the other thing. People don't know. Like, I mean, like, for example, you mentioned Red. And, you know, he was really good to me, man. Back when I first met you, Red was really good to me. He was the president of the Cauliflower Alley after Lou had stepped down. And actually after Lou had passed. And yes. Red, man, that guy was like just a gold-hearted human being. I remember having some of the best times with him. He was so goddamn funny. Same with Nick Bockwinkle. And I would call up Billy Wicks on my cell phone and put him on speakerphone. And man, him and Red, they would just sit there and insult each other and have the goddamn best time. I'm glad you mentioned Red Bastien, because he's a guy who I don't think gets enough. People don't remember him, you know.
Heck of a wrestler.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
You wrestle for a while, and then how did you stumble into Crockett? Jim Crockett Promotions.
That's who I was trying out for, Crockett Promotions. See, the thing about it is, I was going from high school wrestling to the major leagues of professional wrestling.
Wow.
Crockett was, you know, he was major league.
So that tryout with the Andersons was with Crockett Promotions.
Yes, that
I
was
see.
Crockett.
Okay,
he
okay, sorry.
Year, look for new talent. He had an open tryout once a year to look for new talent. And this was for his promotion. So when I started getting booked, 11 months later, I was booked in the NWA with Crockett Promotions wrestling the top guys.
Wow.
So, you know, I didn't go through independent wrestling and then go to the major leagues. Like a lot of guys do today, they'll start off an independent league and then go into the work their way into the major leagues. I did the opposite. I started right off in the major leagues at
wow.
the strike.
Wow. Yeah, that's so, actually, I think, harder in some ways because, you know, when you go out and make a name for yourself in the indies and then get booked on a show, they know you could sell tickets. So they're not even going to fucking bother. You know, they're like, well, whatever. But a young guy like you, they're just going to run you ragged to make you what they want because right. they got to sell those tickets. And it's funny, and I'll let you continue, but I'm just having this thought. You know, those kind of open tryouts as a promoter, that's actually really smart in terms of maintaining kayfabe, right? Because how many of those guys that you went to that tryout with, how many of those guys made it?
I was the only one.
And how many guys were there?
27, I believe. 20-some guys, yeah.
So 27 of these big, badass collegiate athletes wash out. You don't think they're going to go back and tell their friends, and their friends are like, oh, that shit's fake. And they're like, dude, I couldn't make it through that tryout.
Let me tell you, Ole Anderson made a believer out of them that day. Let me tell you.
Yeah.
I saw football players. There was several football players from, I think it was University of South Carolina, Gamecocks. And they were some big, big linemen. They were big guys. And Ole Anderson whooped up on them. One guy was crying. I mean, he tore them up. And so there was no slouches there. These guys, they were all athletes, legitimate athletes. They wouldn't even bite you if you weren't some type of athlete because you had to submit a resume. So if you weren't some type of athlete, you weren't even invited. So.
Yeah, but that says something about you too also in so far as, you know, this is just something that's when you get on the other side of the business and not buying tickets but selling them, you get to understand that, you know, for a guy like you, sure, you got up to 220, but that was work. That's not your natural size. And you were just a smaller guy compared to everybody else at that tryout, right? You said second smallest guy. And they're such like size queens in wrestling because that's what sells is these giant freak show guys. That's an easy sell for a promoter. But yeah. For you to really do what you did at your size back then, before there was like all this kind of cruiserweight and, you know, the Japanese stuff that's gotten popular, that's really saying something for you to make it.
Well, most guys back then, yeah, they liked the bigger guys back then. They just figured that the people would rather see two big guys go at it than two small guys. But yeah, you're right. It was most of the guys, if you weighed 220, you were considered junior heavyweight.
Wow.
And so
that is crazy. So you're with Jim Crockett and you're traveling. Is that where you ended up wrestling Shamrock?
No, I had stopped wrestling for Crockett. After I met Lou, I met Lou while I was wrestling for Crockett. Once Lou took me under his wing and started training me, Lou, you know, kind of brought to my attention that the Crockett's not helping me. That's not what I need. It's not helping my career along, which I already knew, but, you know, where else was I going to go?
Right.
Anyway, Lou was like my guidance. He told me, look, you know, you got to get away from these people. You're not the type of talent they want.
Yeah.
They were getting into the steroids and all that stuff and the gimmicks. And Lou knew how I felt about wrestling. I mean, we talked about wrestling all the time, about holds and not the gimmicks, but the holds and the attitudes and all that. And so he knew how I really loved the sport and felt about it. And he just kind of took me under his wing. But But what I, to make a long story short, I started working for George Scott's promotion, NAWA, North American Wrestling Association. And it was a it was something like a Crockett promotion, because Crockett had already sold out the Ted Turner at the time, and the territory was kind of wide open. So George Scott, who was a booker for Crockett for years, started his own promotion along with Paul Jones and several other old timers. And I started working for them, and they had Nelson Royal had trained Ken Shamrock, which he was working on the Vince Torelli. And they said he was a pretty good amateur, and he was a tough guy. He was winning all these tough men competitions around the state. And so George Scott and told Lou that he would like to for me to come down for TV and have a match with this guy. Well, they were promoting a tournament for their title there. And they booked us together at this Winston-Salem Coliseum. And
so what year is that, to your best recollection?
I think this was like 91.
Wow.
But me and Ken had tag team. They had booked us in a tag team. No, I'm sorry. That was after that match. But
so 91. See. So that's well before UFC. That's a couple years, 3 years, 3-4 years before UFC.
Yeah, it was 91. Yeah, because I started going to UWFI in 92. Me and Vince, or Shamrock, whoever you want to call him, we became good friends because he kind of had the same attitude as I did about the business. He was serious about it.
Yep.
And so was I, and we liked the wrestling more so than the gimmicks. And so, you know, we kind of piled around a little bit, and you know, it just kind of, it clicked. I don't understand why we never had more matches against each other. They did one time book us together in a tag team match. I don't know why he feels the same way I did about this, but we were hoping that they would, you know, do something with this and then book us on the circuit against each other, you know?
Yeah, go to city to city and keep the matches going.
Yeah, and because we got a lot of good reviews back from that match. The fans seemed to appreciate it, and you see the old-style wrestling. Johnny Weaver, who was an old-style wrestler, and Dory Funk Jr. came up to me and said, wow, you know, I hadn't seen wrestling like that in years. That's what we need. And we were trying to bring back wrestling. But I don't know, to this day, I don't know why they didn't continue booking us together. But eventually I went to Japan, and so did Shamrock. He went with
Fujiwara.
Fujiwara's group, exactly.
And but now wait, you wrestled Fujiwara too.
Well, I wrestled Fujiwara in 89 when I was working for New Japan Pro Wrestling. Lou had me booked over there. He got me out of Crockett, and he took over all my, he was, I guess you could call him my manager. He took over everything. He handled me as far as my bookings and everything. Got me booked over in Japan for New Japan. And I went over there and stayed a month. And that's where I wrestled Fujiwara. I wrestled Fujiwara about 4 or 5 times.
How'd that go for you?
Oh my gosh, that guy was great. I loved it.
Yeah.
Let me tell you something. I feel like I've been hit by a truck every time I got out of the ring with him, because he would crimp you and do everything, and then he'd headbutt you, you know.
Yeah.
He liked to use his head. But after every match, he would come back to my dressing room and shake my hand and bow, you know, and thank me and said good fight, you know. And I watched him. He didn't do that to everybody. So that made me really, that put me on cloud 9 when he did that.
Respect.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know, you know, what it was, but I respected him. He knows I respected him, and I think he could just see that I really liked to do that type of wrestling. And we would wrestle, you know, and Sagaguchi, who was the booker, he was a big wrestler too, but he was a judo guy. He wanted us to do the more acrobat tumbling type crap. And I told Lou, I said, you know, I'm not that type of person. And, you know, and I tried to tell Fujiwara that, and he understood because he wasn't either. He didn't do that type of stuff. So I think I had I think that gave me an opportunity to wrestle him more because of that. I don't know. They put me against him, but I wrestled a lot of good guys over there. They were good athletes. Ricky Choshu was a good wrestler. I had the chance to wrestle Inoki once in Nagasaki, Japan.
Wow.
But let me tell you, not downgrading Inoki, because he's a great athlete. He's not in the Fujiwara's class.
Oh, yeah.
I can tell you that by being in the ring with both of them and wrestling around with both of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that Carl Gotch used to tell me all the time, too.
Fujiwara was great.
And that's not knocking Inoki. Inoki's a badass.
No,
it's saying how incredible Fujiwara was.
Yes. Yeah, and I used to tell Lou, because I had never heard of Fujiwara before I went over there. And I was telling Lou, it's like, yeah, this Japanese man, Fujiwara, this guy's good. Of course, Lou knew who he was.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that guy's good.
Yeah.
I'm like, this guy knows his stuff, man.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but you know, we've been kind of talking about Lou, but let's kind of talk about that. Like, so, you know, you mentioned that you guys were close and that he ended up kind of managing, he believed in you so much, he ended up kind of being your manager and taking over your affairs. Not unlike how, Ed Stranger Lewis, did for Lou Thez kind of did that for you. And, you know, obviously he had a huge role in the UWFI and you wrestled for them and did very well with them. But I don't think people really know how close you are. Cause you know, everybody, you know, like, it's like with me and Billy Robinson or me and Carl, there's so many people like, oh yeah, I know Carl, but they just met him a couple times or, you know, hung out or this. I mean, Lou Thez at one time was the best man for you. I mean, you not only managed you, you guys were like tight. So how did you go from Crockett Promotions to getting to know Lou and having Lou really take such a liking to you?
He saw me. He would come to the matches once in a while in the Hampton Coliseum and the Norfolk Scope here. And when Crockett would run shows there, and he would just come in and speak to the boys and sit there and watch the matches. And one night I was wrestling at the Scope, and after my match, I had to put somebody over, obviously. And he came back in the locker room. Well, of course, I knew who he was because I read about him when I was a kid.
Sure.
I never met him. And I didn't think nothing of it. You know, I was there untying my shoes and getting dressed, you know, getting ready to get in the shower. And he was over there talking to Wahoo McDaniel, who was a big time wrestler back then.
Yep.
And he came and he walked around and shook all the boys' hands in the locker room and all. And he came up to me and he shook my hand. And of course, I was like, you know, I was the biggest mark there was for him, you know. And,
yeah.
I never thought he'd talk to me. So I shook his hand and told him it was nice. It was an honor meeting him and everything. And I continued getting undressed. And he said, so, I watched your match. He said, you wrestled a little bit, haven't you? I was like, yeah, I wrestled a little bit. I know enough to get myself in trouble, I guess. He said, well, I can tell the way you handled yourself in the ring tonight. He says, you know, I guess he could just pick up on the way I was carrying myself and the way I did some holds or whatever. And he says, I think you got some potential or something to that effect. I can't remember exact words, but I told him, I said, well, I love wrestling, and you know, and just trying to do the best I can do and make this thing work. And he said, well, I like to work out with you sometime if you're ever around. And he says, I live in Norfolk. I said, well, I said, so do I. That's where I'm from. And he was like, wow. He says, but I see, I was traveling at the time. I wasn't here much in Norfolk. I was going all around. So he says, well, whenever you're in town and we want to get together, give me a call. So he gave me his number, and that's how it happened. And so I took him up on the offer, and I guess it was, wow, it was probably a good 6 months, I guess, before I got back up with him. Because, you know, I was on the road.
Yeah, making a living.
Yeah, I was trying to, I was working for Crockett full time then.
Yep.
And, so finally we got together, make a long story short. And he invited me over his home, and you know, we just sat there and talked forever. And it was funny because one of the first things he ever asked me, he said, "Do you smoke?" I said, "No, sir, I don't smoke. Never have." He said, "Good, never do."
Yeah.
So I don't know where that came from. I don't know nothing about that, but I just thought that was kind of odd. And then he says, he just started asking me about my amateur. And of course I was kind of shy because I didn't want him to think I was some great big college athlete wrestler, you know?
Sure.
And I said, you know, I just wrestled at school, and I just told him how I got involved with Crockett and all that. And he's like, well, good. He says, let's make plans to work out one day. So yeah, I guess it was 2 or 3 weeks later, we got together and we worked out, and he would watch me work out with this guy, and I'm talking on the mat. I'm not talking about working professional style. And he would say, well, let me show you this. You know, he never told me that's wrong, this is wrong. He would always suggest.
Yep.
He said, well, let me show you this and see if you like this better, see if this works better for you. And then that's how we kind of started. And then I was like, wow, this guy, you know, he wants to show me stuff. He's really trying to take time with me. So I started making more time for him. And it just blossomed from there. And he thought the same way I did. And he recognized that I thought the same way he did about our philosophy on wrestling, special professional, because you got to remember there again, there was no MMA or anything like that. It was no mention of catch wrestling or... It was just wrestling. To Lou, wrestling was wrestling.
Right.
I don't care if it was freestyle, Greco, professional style, submission style, whatever. Wrestling was wrestling. And that's how we just kind of got close, just talking about and him demonstrating stuff on me. And it's like he kind of enjoyed molding me. I learned later as we kept working out, a couple of years later, his wife told me one day, she said, you know, I blame you for getting Lou back involved in the wrestling business. I was like, what do you mean? She says, you know, he lost complete interest in it, in the business, until you came along. She says, and he's like obsessed with it again.
Yeah, that's saying something.
Well, yeah, that made me feel great, you know, and that just gave me confidence to work out with him, you know, because I was kind of apprehensive. I didn't know, you know what I'm saying? It's just,
yeah, I do, because I had that same experience with Billy in a way, you know,
but, he was the type of guy. Now, if you screwed up, you did something wrong or you did something stupid, he would tell you, or he would say, don't do that move no more. He said, that ain't, you're not doing it right. And it ain't no good anyway. So don't do it no more. I mean, he would tell me.
Yeah.
And, you know, he wasn't easy to work with either. He was a stickler for working out. Once he took me and started working out with me, it wasn't no, I called him Mr. Thez for a long time. I said, Mr. Thez, you know, if I wanted a day off or do something, he's like, we're not in this to take days off, you know?
Yeah.
So you be at the gym at certain time and I'll be there. And you were there.
Yeah. Professional, man. That's being a professional, taking it serious, you know?
That's right. He told me, he says, you know, if you're not serious about this, he says, I don't waste nobody. I don't waste my time on nobody that's not serious about wrestling. And I told him, I said, well, sir, I'm serious about it. He says, the next thing is, quit calling me Mr. Thez. Call me Lou. Mr. Thez is my father.
So let me ask you something, though. I hate to interrupt again, but this is just so fascinating. And I know that other people want to hear these stories. And we're already rolling up on an hour, if you can believe it. I know it's like we could probably bullshit for hours and hours. But so that had to be a little intimidating going from even the tough, you know, kind of wrestling that you were used to getting booked over to Japan in the UWFI. I mean, what was that transition like? Because first of all, you're wrestling here in the States, you get to know everybody, you're broken in, you're getting respect. But now you're going to Japan where they're crazy as hell. And there's like, you know, this whole kind of real shoot vibe going on. I mean, what was that like, that transition from kind of the American scene into the UWFI?
Well, I'll tell you a little story. You ever heard of Rick Steiner? He's a wrestler.
Yeah.
He's a good amateur too. He found out, this is when I was getting ready to quit Crockett. And see, I was still working for Crockett a little bit when Thez was helping me out. But we were at a match one time and he says, when I was still working out with Lou, he says, I hear you, Lou Thez is going to book you in New Japan. I said, yeah. I says, you know, I don't know nothing about it, but I know that he wants to send me over there. And Rick Steiner told me, he says, let me tell you something. There ain't no joke over there. He said, I went over there. That's no joke. I said, well, yeah, I'm aware of that. And all that. I was warned by some of the American wrestlers.
And tough ones. I mean, you know, Rick Steiner's a tough
SOB. He's been over there. And he told me, he says, you know, just protect yourself because they're tough over there. Well, the reason Lou booked me there is because he told me, he says, look, he says, you're working hard for Crockett and it's not getting you nowhere. He said, you're a wrestler. He said, you were born about 50 years too late. Mm. For your style, he says, they're not working the same way you're wrestling now. He said, but I do know a place that does, and that's when he told me about Japan.
Mm.
He says, I'm gonna book in Japan. He says, they're more your style. They would appreciate your style more than the American style, and you'd fit in more over there. And you know, I didn't know either, so I just said okay. A lot of Americans didn't like going over there because the guys, they were really tough. They would try you. The Japanese would try you.
Yeah, that's what I always heard from almost everybody. It was like those old days. Like, you know, if you couldn't really go, they would just fucking take liberties with you. And you just get eaten alive.
That's right. That's right. Okay, so, you know, Japan was tough, and it was just, it was more my style, my speed, and he saw that in me and sent me over there, so.
Yeah, and I mean, that stable of wrestlers on the UWFI was insane. I mean, you had you, had
Gary. Well, I'm talking about, this was New Japan.
New Japan. How'd you get booked into UWFI?
Well, came back here. I was working at his school as the coach there, and we were training guys and wrestling. And UWFI, it was called UWF, is what it was originally, had started up, and they were it was this guy named Maeda who was in charge of it, and they were having a big match at a tennis court over there, tennis stadium. And they contacted Lou. They saw an article about me in the Gong magazine over there.
Mm.
And they contacted Lou about wanting to book me. So they sent over... golly, this Japanese guy, guy from Tennessee. He was a pro wrestler anyway. He was one of their scouts. He came and scouted me at our gym, And I guess, I don't know, I guess he liked what he saw. So anyway, a couple of days later, he sent Anjo over. Anjo was he's the guy that went up against Gracie or something in some kind of confrontation they had.
Yeah, in a gym match. Yeah, they had a gym match.
Yes. He tried to challenge Gracie. Anyway, he was one of the wrestlers for UWFI, and he was kind of the scout, I guess. So he came over here and scouted me, and he offered me a contract right then after he watched me work out a little bit with, you know, my partner there. And I just went from there. Lou told me it was a different style of wrestling. It was on a point system, and Lou didn't understand it all either. So once I got over there, they explained everything, and they had been in business, I don't know, a year or so, I guess. I don't know, maybe a couple of years, because Gary had already been over there and a couple other guys. But he just booked me and signed my contract right there. And after every match, every show over there, they would offer you a new contract if they wanted you back. And I was just lucky enough to be offered more contracts, you know, to go back.
Well, what's interesting is, like, so you have Bad News Allen, who's like a legitimate judo, tough guy. You have Gary Albright, who's just a beast. You have, like, Dan Severn in his prime. I mean, that is a crazy, crazy roster, that UWFI roster. And you did well. You got all the way up to number two, just behind Albright, right?
Well, I was over there before Dan Severn.
Wow.
Dan Severn had never been there yet.
Wow.
I was there the first time. I'd already been a couple times before Dan Severn ever went. Gary Albright was there. A guy named Tom Burton was there. Mm. A couple other guys, but Dan Severn hadn't come yet. And
Billy Scott, Gene Lydick, those guys were there, right?
Billy Scott wasn't there the first time I went there, but he had already been there.
I see.
I was never over there with Billy Scott. But he had already been there. And then later, after I left, he had come back and started being booked over there.
I see. So you guys kind of just missed each other.
We missed each other, yeah.
I see.
But Gary was always there when I was there. And then once they booked Dan Severn and saw how good he was, you know, he became a regular.
Yeah.
So they kind of had their regular guys. They had picked to keep coming back and forth. But, one of the magazine guys told me, he says, the magazines, which it really doesn't mean anything. It's just, I guess, for the fans. But the writer for the magazine told me that, Gary Albright is ranked number one and you're ranked number two as the guy jeans, you know, the foreigners.
Foreigner, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, that didn't really... It meant something to the fans, but not to us, really. But it was a whole different ball game, because I told Lou, I says, I'm not interested in learning how to kick, and I've never done anything like that. I've always just wrestled, and I told Takata and all these guys that were in charge and Miyato, I says, look, I don't really want to wear these shin pads because I've never worn them, you know. Of course, Lou told me, he said, just wear them because it's showing them respect. That's their rules or whatever. So, you know, we would wear those things. But it was just a whole different ball game, you know. I would keep going for pins, and there was no pinfalls.
Well, that's what I was just thinking, is it's like, because I know Billy used to just go on and on about it. Because they brought Billy, Lou, and Danny Hodge. I mean, the UWFI was truly a magical, like, if you were into, like, it was before MMA, but I really feel it was that, and then that Shoot Wrestling It's Real pay-per-view that launched MMA. Because right after that pay-per-view in the United States, then the UFC got the idea, and then here we are today. But Billy used to bitch, man. He's like, we would tell those Japanese guys, like, you can't take out the pin. But, you know, at the same time, they're paying your check, you know, paying you a check. And right. What are you going to do? You know, you can't.
That's what Lou said. You know, I told him, I says, I'm used to pinning these guys and I'm going for the pin. And, you know, he's like, you know what? Just play by their rules. He says, you know, it's a whole different ball game, but just play by their rules. So, you know, what are we going to do? You know, we were getting paid. But well, you're right. I agree with you. That was part of, I think, the startup of these MMA and this UFC stuff, because we were drawing big crowds over there.
Huge. I mean, you guys were filling out like the big stadiums, like 70,000 people and stuff.
We were outdrawing New Japan and All Japan.
Wow.
Several shows we outdrew them. So we were, you know, we were doing pretty daggone good, and it was really catching on. And the thing about it is, what I liked is that the fans really, they almost knew what we were doing as far as different holds or if you suplexed a guy, you know, or took a guy down, they would clap for you, even if you weren't American, wasn't a Japanese, you know. So it was like they appreciated us wrestling that way, you know. They appreciate the style.
Well, you know, Japan is great in that regard, I think, just because, you know, while we're over here kicking balls, throwing balls, passing balls, they're doing combat sports with, you know, in for their kids. You know, they're very oriented culturally towards combat. So, you know, you always hear that the guys that go over there and wrestle, they're just like, man, it was quiet, but it wasn't quiet because it was bad. It was quiet because they were paying attention and giving a shit.
Exactly. That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, it was, I really enjoyed my experiences over there. And with the New Japan Pro Wrestling also, I enjoyed. But I really enjoyed my experiences over there with UWFI. You know, they really helped me out. I learned a lot. I worked out with Billy Robinson one time. He was over there. He was wrestling in an exhibition with Nick Bowinkle.
Yeah.
And have you heard this? He was.
I saw the match. I know that he regretted it because he was like, I know he needed the money. He was kind of in a bad way at that time in his life. And he regretted it because he was like, man, I was so out of shape. I shouldn't have done that match. But he did. I'm glad he did it.
We went to the dojo that morning. Me and Gary always hung out together. And we would always work out together. And Billy Robinson was there. Well, gee, that's the first time I ever met him. And of course, we knew who he was, and Danny Hodge was there, and so was Lou. But Billy Robinson rolled in the ring. He said, me and Gary was sitting there stretching out and all. He says, okay, who wants to wrestle?
He's got to be in his 60s by then.
Yeah, I guess. I says, well, I'll wrestle because, you know, I just wanted to roll around with him just because of who he was.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like just like Lou Thesz to me. And I had known his background, and I said, well, I want to wrestle around with you.
Yeah.
So we wrestled around. And he showed us some stuff, you know. He was he showed us a lot of stuff, but we didn't really have a lot of time with him as far as, I mean, I know he trained a lot of guys. That was before he was staying over there. Then I think eventually they hired him to be their coach for the guys over there.
Yeah.
But this was before that. And, but yeah, I mean, I got to roll around with him one time. And, he would show Gary and myself some stuff. And then being there with Danny Hodge, golly, them three together, Danny Hodge, Lou Thesz, and Billy Robinson, me and Gary always piled around with them. And they would just keep us laughing. Because of the way they would do things to each other and rib each other and everything. It was really funny.
Yeah, that's quite an amazing room to be in. I mean, that is really the elite of the elite of 20th century badass wrestlers with those three, you know?
That's right. That's exactly right. And just, you know, being around those three guys, that's just like the best wrestlers that ever lived in our lifetime, you know. And it was I don't know if the other guys appreciated it, but I really appreciated the time spent with these guys, and just to listen to their stories and learn what I could from them. And it was really an honor to be around these guys. And they love the sport. It was just a good camaraderie, you know. It's hard to explain.
Well, because all those guys had a similar kind of vision, and they had similar experiences as legit guys in this kind of kayfabe biz, and then you guys finally get to have a promotion where you at least have that shoot vibe. I mean, that must have been really an electric time.
Yes, it was. It was. And then when they ended up bringing Vader in there, that's when it died. Part, yeah. That I know they were really disappointed in that decision, but I guess they had to do what they had to do to draw more money. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like any business, you know. You take gambles, and unfortunately, sometimes the gambles you take end up destroying the whole thing, you know.
Yeah, I was there when they brought in the Iron Sheik. You know, he was a heck of a wrestler in his day.
Yeah.
But he was old and beat up and done by then. And he was on his way out. But
that's a process that we all go through, you know, in our own ways. Because, I mean, you know, my spine is completely jacked, and most of it is a combination of wrestling, and then I had cancer when I was a kid, and that was just a bad combo for my spine. But you've had like totally heinous back and spine issues too, right?
Oh, I'm fighting them to this day. I've got neck problems, spine problems. Sit down and have a seat. I'll tell you the whole story.
Yeah.
You know, I've got so many daggone injuries, and you know, I can understand. I used to look at these old guys and say, it'll never be me. But I tell my wife all the time, I'm there. And it's a shame because I'm 57 years old, and I feel like, wow, I feel like I've been hit by a truck. And, you know, I never thought it would happen to me. But I guess that's just part of the business, you know.
Well, and this goes to our conversation at the very beginning of this, before the podcast. I mean, I knew you back, yeah, like back in 2003, I was still pro wrestling and going, you know, on the indie circuit and stuff. And I was trying to get my head right. And I reached out to you, and you were really great. I mean, you really helped me get my head around some things that I was having a problem with at that time in the business. And shortly thereafter, though, like you know, because you had retired. But now you have your own gym, and shit, your gym's been going since what, 2007 or 2006?
2004.
That's right. Shit, man, that is crazy.
Yeah, it's I've been doing here like almost 15 years now, and of course I don't coach wrestling no more. I get a lot of calls on it, but
I don't have
enough room in this facility that I'm in. Just didn't have the room.
But this said that. Wait, now that said. For those of you guys that want to learn from this man, go to pinandsubmit.com. www.pin, and the word and, submit.com, and scroll through there. I got you, Severn, Billy Scott, guys from the UWFI. We'll come out to your gym. You guys we'll fly you guys out there because you have a wealth of knowledge that I really feel needs to be passed on. So, guys, pay attention to that. And then also Mark's book with Scott Teal. It's Wrestling, Not Wrestling. And then the thing that we didn't even mention is the DVD project you and I did together your gym, which you filmed at your gym, which is like a strength and conditioning gym. It's a weightlifting gym there in Virginia. And it's called Wrestling with Weights. And it's your program, if you're going to a gym, what kind of weights, how you could use the machines to help augment your wrestling, your conditioning.
Right. It's a bunch of exercises that, it's some of the exercises that I used under Lou and just for wrestling in general or just bodybuilding in general.
Well, I liked it because, you know, I'd always had a problem with my neck, and now it looks like a noodle because all the damage and atrophy and shit that's happened to it. But back then, I really needed to know how to protect it, and I used all your neck exercises for years and years and years. That's really a great DVD.
Well, yeah, it shows a lot of network, and it's just the stuff that, like I say, Lou taught me, and some of the stuff we did. You know, it's nothing sophisticated. It's just stuff that we did in amateur wrestling and professional wrestling, and just the way Lou trained me.
Yeah, that's amazing. Guys, if you want to get a hold of Mark, Mark, what's the best way? Does Fleming's Gym have a website, or what's the best way for people to reach out to
you? Yeah, Fleming's Gym has it's flemingsgym.net. Or you could Facebook, Fleming's Gym Facebook, or Facebook me under Mark Fleming. You can message me and go that way.
Brilliant. Well, listen, man, I got to have you back on because I know when we get to talking, it just goes. It's like 2 hours and it's like we don't even know. But
I could talk wrestling for hours.
Yeah, same here, brother. So, guys, check out Mark Fleming. If you want the DVD, we have it at scientificwrestling.com. If you want to check out his book, it's Wrestling, Not Wrestling, with Scott Teal. This is a great book. I mean, it really is. And you guys know me. If it ain't good, I'll say it. And this is a good book. It's so, I mean, if you're into the wrestling business, especially kind of the shoot side, and then check out Fleming's Gym, guys. You can actually go down there and shoot the breeze about wrestling. And you got a bunch of cool memorabilia at your gym too, don't you?
Oh yeah. I've got the walls covered with, different guys that I've wrestled or knew, and, pictures of when I was wrestling over in Japan. And so it makes for an interesting conversation piece. You know, the people seem to like it. So,
well, hey, Mark, thank you so much for taking time to tell your story.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thanks for having me, Jake.
Yeah, anytime. Okay, guys, that wraps another. I mean, I don't know about you guys listening, but I'm having a hell of a time doing this podcast. So check out Mark, and I'll catch you guys on the next episode. Thanks for tuning in.